99.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online at WERU.org. Stay tuned. We've got Power for the People with your host, Steve Call, up next.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from the Mabel Wadsworth Women's Health Center, providing comprehensive reproductive and sexual health services for all women of all ages and all stages since 1984. Insurance, main care, Dirigo, and self-pay accepted. MabelWadsworth.org.
Good morning. This is Power for the People on WERU-FM. My name is Steve Call, your host for the next hour, to talk about how people can take control of their energy future, and in particular take control of their energy budget going forward. And philosophically, we're in a period of low fossil fuel prices right now, and that causes some people to doze off, I suppose, relative to their costs. But let's view that as an opportunity to divert some resources to doing the right thing relative to your budgets. My guest this morning is Jim Merkel, who is a number of things and has been a number of things. He's the author of the book Radical Simplicity. What a great title for a book that is. He's the former sustainability director at Dartmouth College, and I share that in common with him, being a former sustainability director of a local college. Professionally, he's doing other things recently, including a film that we'll chat about here, that all point towards sustainability and energy efficiency. You also, Jim, are definitely walking the talk relative to your own home. And so I think there's a number of ways where we can inform people about ways that they can take control of their own energy future and live more sustainably. And it's a little bit hard to know where to even start because there's so many good things to talk about here. Mm. But maybe welcome. Glad to have you here. And maybe we can start with a little bit of discussion. I think that it would be helpful for people to know about your life story, because you were kind of one of them in the past, and now you're one of us, if you will. Tell us a little bit about how you evolved and wound up writing Radical Simplicity, for example.
Yeah, well, it's great to be with you, Steve. And we've worked together over at Unity College, and it was really fun to get to know Steve while he was there, and I was teaching, and he was their new sustainability coordinator director. And so we had so much in common, and we sat down to talk. We could just keep going on and drinking coffee. So it's great. And when I was a kid, you know, I was really excited to be an engineer, and my dad thought engineers were cool. He was really conservative guy, and I kind of grew up, you know, with those conservative values. I was probably like a young Republican kid. So I went off to engineering school, and then I came out and got a job out in California for the offense industry, which I didn't call it then. But my first day at work at ITT, at Vandenberg Air Force Base out in California, there was protesters at the gate, and I go in and I say, well, what are those protesters there for? And the engineer who's going to like take me under his wing says, oh, we launch missiles from here, and we blow up the Marshall Atolls for target practice, and we've relocated the indigenous people. And I came to learn we've done so many above ground nuclear tests there and all this stuff. So my first year there was painful almost, because I was a kind of a, you know, you'd see the missile when you'd enter the base, Vandenberg Air Force Base. I was a hired contractor, one of 10,000 people being paid like a, you know, good salary to work on weapon systems. But, it, you know, people, they would launch these missiles, and half the people would say, oh my God, there goes another Marshall Atoll. Another half would say, God bless America. And the missiles would say, missiles for peace. And we all go back into work and do our job. And that gave me a stomachache after a while. But then I got another job in for TRW, and I got a top secret clearance, and I designed the top secret crypto box, like a BlackBerry of the day. And that thing had to work underwater, you know, to transmit top secret information. And in my 20s, I had like 25 engineers working for me. And then I'm marketing it all over Europe, and I'm meeting with arms dealers. And I'm meeting with an arms dealer, and he says, well, I have clients in both Iraq and Iran. That's while they're at war in the 80s. And I come back to the president of my company. He says, how can we sell to both sides of the war? And he says, well, it's not for you to decide. It's the State Department. And so I started, like, the Liberty Bell started cracking in my head, you know, what I had been told as a kid, because we had to, like, climb under the desks, you know, for air defense drills in elementary school. And all of a sudden, I started realizing, wait a minute, are we really the problem on the planet? And then I saw the Valdez oil spill. I'm in Stockholm, Sweden, and I'm meeting the Swedish military. And a five-star hotel, the Valdez spill comes on the TV, and I'm at the bar, and I cried. And I said, this place I dreamed of going to as a kid is like, look at this. And I looked in the mirror across the bar, and I said, I'm the guilty one. I drive my car every day. And I came home, and I parked my car, and I'm like, I'm not driving anymore. And I got my bicycle out. I was a bicycle rider, and I put the pannier bags on and went shopping. I went to the grocery store, and I had to walk out because I couldn't buy packaged products anymore. And I went to found the co-op in town and brought my own, went there and got all the food from the bulk section. And I just, in 6 months, I had to quit my job because I couldn't be an environmentalist in the night anymore and do like a day job that was like part of destroying the planet. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I just locked myself in the house because I was having an ethical hemorrhage, you know, to be working in this painful job. And I just asked myself, well, what do I need instead of how much I could get? And I realized, like, if I took my car off the road and rented out three of the bedrooms in my house, planted a veggie garden, I could live on $5,000 a year. And I ran the numbers back and forward, and I realized at 30 years old, I had enough money to live off my interest for the rest of my life. So I quit work, and I basically still haven't touched the original capital I started with 25 years ago. And I've been living on a pretty simple budget, not $5,000 every year. Some years more. I built a house, so I spent a lot more of the few 3 years I was building the house. But I still have the same capital I began with, more or less. And more or less been a volunteer for 20 years, except for the 2 years at Dartmouth. But it was a big journey, and it put me right on the road of, like, how can I live my – I felt like in the beginning I need to change me first. That was, like, the big piece. And that was, like, for me, fun as an engineer, the challenge of, like, getting my own footprint really low. But then the other part, once I got it lower, was how do I work for change in society?
Well, I think it's the epiphany is and ought to be an inspiration to everybody, and you know, being that radically simple, you know, to pick up the title of the book, Radical Simplicity, is not something that everybody can do as quickly as you did, but it's an inspiration. And you and I have talked about it in reading the book. I realized that I was already moving in that direction, but not moving nearly fast enough. And so you've just given a little synopsis of the early part of the book, and so anybody who wants to dive into it in more detail, the book is certainly the possibility. Tell us, where did Dartmouth fit in there? And we've talked about in the past being a sustainability coordinator is the second most frustrating job in the world. We don't know what the most frustrating job is, but it's certainly second. Where did that fit into this time frame? And give us a little idea on that experience.
Sure. I had been running a lot of programs. I started my own nonprofit, Global Living Project, out in British Columbia. And we had run five teams of researchers who would live on the land for 6 weeks, quantifying every single thing they consumed for a six-week period. So like the biosphere, too, we were a research team that was actually saying, well, we already have a biosphere. Let's not try to engineer a new dome, but engineer ourselves to live within the dome. So after five of these teams, I moved back east when my dad was really ill to help take care of him. He lived in Maine. And so when I got back east, we found a new homestead in Vermont. And I'm growing potatoes and homesteading and leading workshops on simple living, money management, all these different topics that I'm passionate about on the weekends at this new homestead after we left BC in Vermont. And my friend started sending me this job ad for a job at Dartmouth, and I wasn't looking for work. And after I got it in my inbox like five or six times, I said, I'm going to apply, you know, and there's like 130 applicants, and I went through 30 interviews, and I went from like the bottom of the list to at the end, like I knew somebody on the hiring committee, and it was unanimous from the committee to hire me because they wanted somebody who actually was trying to walk their talk. You know, the day I went in for my interview, I didn't have an iron anymore because I'd gotten rid of it, and I'm living off the grid on this house in Vermont that had no power, just two solar panels, and I heated up on the wood stove this block of iron that was used to hold the door from swinging. It was one of these old irons, you know, the old-fashioned one. I heat up on the wood stove and iron my shirt to go to the interview. But it was a fun 2 years in many ways and also frustrating. But then I really wanted to see what it would be like to work these ideas into bigger systems. And when I arrived at Dartmouth, The students were totally behind it. The staff was totally behind it. The faculty was all on board for doing everything we could sustainably. They had just gone, like, from 2004 to 2005, their energy bill went from $4 to $7 million, just over. And as you said, the energy prices are down. And I used to say when I was there, the ears grow in proportion to the price of energy at the pump for sustainability. And so we're in a challenging time when, we've done so much fracking and flooding the markets with this horrible energy under, like, an Obama, 8 years of Obama, who supports this kind of unregulated fracking, that the energy prices are going down. And it makes it a little harder, but still, because people lose some of the motivation, but the motivation is still there. So at Dartmouth, I found, like, a real support for at every level of the institution. And the hard thing was upper administration was tough, because they had a board of trustees who were mostly conservative. And they would take pot shots at me like crazy. They would never talk to me. They would just write these horrible things about this guy who they hired, to be a sustainability coordinator. But the whole campus was behind it. It was just a small group who put a lot of... And certain administrators then had to cover their tush a bit to... And were worried. They would look over your shoulder like crazy, to make sure you're not going to ruffle any feather, and it limited what we could get done.
Yeah, that the upper administration has a number of things on their agenda in any institution, as we well know. And one of the challenges, in fact, we had at the last main climate summit in Portland a year ago, we actually ran a panel. I organized a panel on the challenges of being a sustainability coordinator. And part of the issue was you had to get the attention of the upper administration and be a member of the cabinet, for example. Or better yet, we need a sustainability director to become president of an institution sometime to show them how they can get things done.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let's continue along that line. But I do just want to say that this is, first of all, this is Pledge Week. And so the phone number here is 800-643-6273, and there are operators standing by. The call-in number for this program, and we'll open the phones here in a few minutes, is 866-625-9378. That's 866-625-WERU. And my guest is Jim Merkel, who has all sorts of credibility relative to sustainability and energy issues. We do want to come back and do some real-world examples from that both of us can speak to relative to what you can do in your own home, and we'll get to that in a few minutes as well. Is your sense that Dartmouth has managed to maintain? So as you said, and I think this is just so true in academic institutions in general, the students and the faculty want to do the right thing. They just need some guidance and some investment resources. And one of my concerns is that the administration, especially conservative administrators, since you mentioned that, view sustainability and energy sustainability as energy initiatives as investments, or even anti-American in some ways, if you're in the drill baby drill category of society. Is your sense that Dartmouth is still, from the bottom up, still supportive of that kind of thing? What's happening over there?
Yeah, they're totally supportive. And, after I left, it was very interesting. The past president was an ex-Marine, and he built several athletic buildings during his tenure as president of Dartmouth. And they had the students, the first year I was there, read the book Mountains Beyond Mountains about Dr. Paul Farmer and his work in Haiti to help the poorest of the poor people. And Dartmouth has a medical school and a huge hospital. So the students, after reading this book over the summer, it was required reading for every freshman coming in, about this guy who's like sleeping in a basement apartment and going to Harvard Med School, and every chance he could get flying down to Haiti to help the poorest of the poor people. These kids at Dartmouth who could imagine themselves with a swimming pool and three vacation houses. If you were to tell them, like, or ask them, would you like to be a Dr. Paul Farmer helping the poorest of the poor people living in a basement apartment, or do you want this life of privilege and excess? And after they read the detailed story of Paul Farmer, these kids wanted that life. They wanted to be an agent of change on the planet, and they were on fire. It was so amazing. And after that, Dartmouth got these huge grants lined up for public health initiatives. Then they hired, as new president was Kim Jim-young, I think is his name.
He's now president of the World Bank.
Now president of the World Bank. He was their president. He was the financier who helped Dr. Paul Farmer like start hospitals in Lima, Peru. And if you read the book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, you'll see his story. So it was like a coup d'etat at Dartmouth. I couldn't believe it. And this was happening just through the middle of the mid-2000s. You know, coast to coast, there were sustainability coordinators in every campus. The first gathering I went to was like 400 sustainability coordinators. And next year was like 1,200 sustainability coordinators. They were everywhere, and we were all sharing information. Everyone wanted to see, like, is Yale doing more than us? I would go down to Yale and look at their dining system, 100% organic, a whole dining hall, 100% local organic. So I go back to Dartmouth. Why is Yale doing 100% organic? You're telling me we're at 10 or 20%, and that's enough. So we were all using each other's examples to kind of help each other go further than the other guy. And it was a wonderful environment. And things were happening. Like, if you were to add up all the things happening in higher ed in, you know, 2005 to 2010, it would be like you could basically turn the whole world around. You know, at Dartmouth, we were building buildings that were using one-tenth the energy of our old buildings. And the people sitting there, the engineers and people we were hiring, knew how to do it and were doing it. And they didn't even open a steam valve on this building, right? The engineers didn't get it at Dartmouth yet, all the old people. So they retrofitted an old building. And the students, it was like late December, and the kids were finally said, you know, the building's a little cool. I'm not sure what's happening. And then someone found out they never opened the steam valve. So basically that building had used no energy up to like cold New Hampshire. So finally I heard this story 100 times from all their designers and engineers. And, you know, we had 110 buildings at Dartmouth. They got religion after that. They knew they could do it. They knew they could do the deep energy retrofits. They knew they worked. They knew all the technology was there. They had hundreds of case studies to look at. But when you go out to hire people, 95% of who you're going to hire don't know it. So there was a very select group of people who knew how to deliver the goods. You know, the other people were like floundering.
I think that's an incredibly important message. Working with architects at the small college that you mentioned earlier, in one of the meetings where we said we want to build a net zero energy dorm, and that dorm's not a small building, it was a 70-bed dorm, it was clearly possible to do it as a deep energy retrofit and, in fact, strive for net zero energy. We did design it that way ultimately, but the architects came into the first meeting with the wrong building codes. They were going to insulate the ceilings to R38. Main building code is R49, and other buildings on that campus were R70 and 80.
Yeah.
The cap of the building is the most important place for loss of energy, and they were going to build it to less than code.
Right.
It was astonishing. I'll give you, sorry.
No, that's great.
I'm going to get off on a rant here.
I know.
It was a $4.4 million building.
Yeah.
They did an assessment for super insulating. It was going to cost an additional $18,000 out of $4.4 million. And they said, it's not cost effective.
Right.
And we had to straighten that one out. That was very frustrating.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like at Dartmouth, the CEO at the time, his son was studying at Dartmouth in the environmental studies department. And so I could tell he was getting religion. I was in the provost department, so I would meet with the president, the provost, all the managers. I was in all those meetings, and it was kind of interesting to hear him. One meeting was just mind-blowing because people were saying, oh, it's got to pay, sustainability. You know, I was showing them how it's cheaper to do everything sustainable is cheaper. And I showed him like these going to an absolute beyond LEED design building to a green building actually over 20-year period would actually cost less net present value. You're saving money by doing it. Maybe a little more upfront cost. And he said, well, that works with my, that's my financing. I have 20-year financing. And he gave this little speech in a meeting. He says, look, we don't have a literature program so people, for our cost-benefit analysis, we do it at Dartmouth because that's the right thing to have an institution, liberal arts, putting kids out there, people in the world who are knowledgeable and balanced in what they know. He says, we don't have a sustainability program to make money. We have it to do the right thing. I was like, this is music to my ears at a institution.
But in reality, it's both.
It is both.
I mean, I'm you know, I'm a frugal Yankee and over, and I hate to spend money, but I'm but I'm glad to invest money.
Right.
And
right.
That's the, you know, in my own personal life and for organizations that I work for, and that's the key, because ultimately it does save you money up front. But, and for an institution such as a college, it also builds reputation, which then translates to more students and more sustainability from the financial perspective that way.
Sure.
One thing that students don't realize, if I can just opine for a moment, the example of happening at Missouri is a good one, a completely different topic, obviously, but students have all sorts of power to get things done from the grassroots in an institution like that. And so if there are any students out there or parents of students or grandparents of students, you know, just let them know that they do have power. One of the things that has been true at all of the institutions that I've worked, actually, that recycling has come along not from the top down from the administration. It's because students wanted to recycle. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, even at Unity College, the sustainability school, America's Environmental College, sustainability came along because the students said, hey, why aren't we recycling?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, again, the power from the ground up is really important and incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just remind everybody that this is Pledge Week, and the phone number for to access our operators is 800-643-6273. And we're going to go to a break in a few minutes here and have some of the management for the station do some of the pledge information for you.
Oh, and I got to interrupt here, Steve.
Okay.
I've just been thinking on my way in, listening to WERU as I drove in, and I listened. I'm a regular listener at home in Belfast, and I said, okay, I'm going to go online. I got my nerve up to say, okay, I'm going to pledge and match everybody up to $100 right now on the air. So please call in, and you could try to make me go broke. Please do. Last year, I know my partner was listening, and she called in right away and made it her pledge. So I'm willing to put $100 on the line. I love WERU and regular listener, and I love so much of the programming, and I think it's just vital. And I don't have to hear just think about it, you know, that I have to hear natural gas. Just think about it. I haven't heard that ad yet on WERU, thank God. And when I hear it on an ad for fracking on other public radios, I'm like, they're in your pledge drive. I get a lump in my stomach and I don't call. But at WERU, I don't get that lump in my stomach. There's no lump. It's just donate, you know.
Well, and I'm glad to hear your partner's on board with it, because I was going to say, she called up and said, are you crazy? our budget is $5,000 this year. But I appreciate that. I'm a new member myself, so, again, we need to put our money where our mouth is. You mentioned LEED, and I don't want to let that go by without commenting on it, that programs like LEED, LEED stands for Leadership and Energy Efficiency Design, or whatever the heck it is, and it's a valid approach, and it's a commendable approach, but LEED in particular doesn't focus nearly enough on energy, in my mind. And so you're actually building a non-sustainable building, even if you do LEED Silver.
Mm.
And the insulation values are not what they ought to be. And
right.
So it's easy for people to say, geez, look at us. We're doing LEED buildings. Not enough. Sorry.
Right. I would just say at Dartmouth, you know, we should not even – LEED Silver, to me, they have silver, gold, platinum, and then a living building is going beyond. I was trying to advocate we should go for beyond to the living building, you know, platinum or higher, because if you plan the building from the ground up and get that all that design in, I'm a recovering engineer. You know, when you put that stuff in the engineering in the beginning and in who you're looking for to build the building, it may not cost hardly anything at all. So that's the point to do it. And then, like Dartmouth said, oh, we don't want to do LEED. We'll save the money and we'll do it anyway. I said, okay, we're building 7 projects right now. Let's go look around. I'll take you on a tour right now to the buildings that we're building and see if they're doing LEED. Because they would have runoff going right into the creek, and LEED would say, you can't have runoff, you know. And so all these parts of LEED that other people would diss because it's not just about energy, I thought were important. And then the criticism that it should be more, I agree with you, you know, they could put a higher emphasis on energy. But some of the other aspects of recycled materials, not getting new part, you know, not breaking new ground, you know, using old sites, I thought a lot of them were really important. And the institutions weren't doing them, even though they said they would.
Mm.
So it was like a little checklist that they had to do, and they had to spend a bit of money to do it. I was recommending they do it, you know, but silver to me was a joke. I would say that's just good engineering. gold is just good engineering.
Yes, I mean silver is barely exceeding current main building codes, and so it just doesn't make sense. There are studies out there that have shown, for example, and this is just an example number, that but if you build something to net zero energy standards, you might incur 7%, and you know, pick your number, it could be 5%, it could be 10% additional cost, but you're going to save it back in the first 2 years.
Yeah, and it's so very quick payback.
What's the downside here? So again, I'm speaking with Jim Merkel here in the studio, who is the author of Radical Simplicity, amongst other things. And I'd like to make the transition now, perhaps to bring it back to people's lives, since we've kind of been kind of over the top talking about life philosophy of sustainability and ragging on our experience in higher education institutions, to talk about your specific home right now. And again, maybe causing somebody to think about things or think of a question that they want to call in and ask. So describe what your own, as you've gone through the process of building your own home and operating it. Tell us what that's all about.
Yeah, well, I started with a sawmill. You know, I looked for 3 years for a home, an existing home, and I have super allergies to mold. And I can't live in a house with a moldy basement or, you know, a house poorly built. And so I looked and looked and looked, and finally we bought land, and I started with the sawmill, you know, cleared the site and bought my neighbor's sawmill and milled all the wood and dried it in a big greenhouse that's now growing vegetables. And it's an off-the-grid house with a foot-thick wall. I milled almost every stick in it, including all the finished wood, and then it's completely off the grid. A small solar panel array on the roof, the hot water panels I got off somebody's house down in Deer Isle. The plumber didn't know how to fix it, and she said, I just bought the house, and nobody knows how to fix it, and everything up there was just fine. It's like 30-year-old panels, and I've put them up on the roof of my house, and, you know, I'll go up there yesterday, and it's 130-degree water, like my tank is hot, you know, and so anyway, it's off-the-grid house. It's heated with wood, a wood cook stove, which heats our hot water, heat cooks our food, heats the house. We were going to put backup energy, and we didn't need it. I was going to put backup hot water. I didn't. We didn't need it. And just at the time, I watched the fracking movies, Gaslands and Gaslands 2, and I said, no, I'm not going to heat my water with frack juice, I call it. So that, you know, our hot water, if we get a cool spell in the summer and we don't have sun to have a hot shower, we just run the wood stove and cook our breakfast on it, and then we have a hot shower, cook our dinner on it, we have a hot shower. So we've been they're going in our second year, very efficient, it's fun to build. You know, I was on the project for 2 or 3 years, like almost every day, and we hired a good friend, Gibby Fulford, works with Artisan Builders, and he grew up with his dad, Jonathan Fulford, who's run for political office. He grew up building houses, and he's amazing, very knowledgeable on passive house design. And the things I did was like a Larson truss wall, so it's a foot-thick wall. It's a platform built, two-story, and then strapped out with a 2x3 that I milled. And we did all that and built jigs for it, and it went up really quick and fast. And there's oak timber frame in it. And he wasn't afraid to work and lift these heavy oak timbers. We got all these red oak timbers in the ceiling, a very well-built house, and very tight, very comfortable, and super insulated slab. It's got like 6 inches of foam underneath it. It's like I studied up the passive design and also the how to build a building that doesn't, it's not going to pickle the user with molds or off-gassing of things. So, yeah, it was a fun project, and we are so happy there. And it came out great. Like, all our systems are working fine. Everyone I worked with just about and the whole project was fun to work with. I've heard people complain, like they said, your contractor's who you're going to hate the most in your life, and this wasn't the case.
Hmm. And so how much solar power do you have there?
We just have, it's under two, it's like 1.2K, you know, it's like 1,200 watts of power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a small array. We have to run a pump to pump the water from, you know, 180 feet. That uses quite a bit of energy, and we run a heat recovery system, ventilating the house.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
If it's cloudy, we open windows rather than run it because it'll draw us on a bit. And, you know, we'll use we have a tiny, like, 1,000-watt generator. Last November, we ran it, you know, 5 or 10 times in 2 months. Then we didn't run it for 10 months. I ran it a few days ago for the first time in 10 months, you know, just for like 6 hours, burned like 3/4 of a gallon of gas just to top up my battery, so I don't drain my battery bank and hurt it by leaving it low. Mm-hmm. So we've used probably like 3 gallons of gas a year just to make sure we don't hurt our batteries. That's the main thing.
You know, 3 gallons of gas.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's like, yeah. It's fun. And it's very comfortable. You know, on a hot summer day, it's cool. If we didn't run the heat at all for like in the winter and you went away for like 4 or 5 days, you come home, it's going to be 55 in the house maybe, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, and let's. I got similar experiences that we'll come back to and chat about in my current home and actually a new one that I just bought, where I'll tell you some of my strategies. But we're going to take a break now and go off to the back to the main studio and for Pledge Week. Amy, go ahead.
All right. Yes, this is Amy Brown, and I am here along with
Joel Mann.
And the number is 1-800-643-6273. We've got a matching pledge out there.
Awesome. We want you to get on the phone and show your support for alternative programming, alternative energy, alternative lifestyles, alternative radio.
That's right. And I want to say a little bit about this week. I'm trying to let people know a little bit more about what goes on behind the scenes with these public affairs shows at 10 o'clock in hopes that you'll call in and support them during the actual shows while they're here so they know that you're listening and that you appreciate their shows. We know a lot of people call in during the music shows and mention the public affairs shows, and we're grateful for that. But give a call now while we've got the program on so that they can hear that you really appreciate Power for the People and Steve Call and the work that they're doing here. And I want to say a little bit about Steve's background, because
Absolutely.
One of the great things about the hosts here is we have members of the community who are specialists in the area that they're hosting shows on, so they know the questions to ask. They already know the background. They know the people in the community to bring on. Steve Call, your host of this program you've been listening to, is an environmental and renewable energy consultant. He has an extensive background in the field of alternative energy. Some highlights include he has developed a no upfront cost fossil fuel free energy plan for a small college, a net zero energy retrofit for an office building. He's worked on solar projects for public buildings. He's on the Unity Regional Energy Committee, serves on the board of directors of the Unity Barn Raisers, and he is currently an associate professor of environmental science at Thomas College. So if you appreciate having members of the community donate their time to come in and host programs on these topics, give us a call.
That's so true. 1-800-643-6273. Volunteers from our community coming here and sharing their knowledge to make this community a better place to live for everyone. 1-800-643-6273. It's so important that you show your support for spoken word programming. Music is great. Spoken word programming is great. Altogether, that's what makes WERU so great. 1-800-643-6273. Please let us hear from you today.
And take advantage of that matching gift that was offered by the guest, Jim Merkel. Now call 1-800-643-6273.
All righty.
We'll turn the show back over to the guys in the studio. Thank you for listening.
One of the topics that we've touched on here that Jim mentioned a few minutes ago was fracking resulting in natural gas and the potential for natural gas as a fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our esteemed governor is correct when he says we're too reliant on heating oil. But then there are people out there who say, well, let's move to natural gas. And and I have a real problem with moving from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel, regardless of your view on fracking or anything like that. To me, it just doesn't make sense to move to another fossil fuel. And, of course, natural gas, the argument is that it burns cleaner because it doesn't produce so much CO2. Natural gas is also mostly methane, which is a 40 times stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And you know that every fitting that you put together for gas is going to leak. You know that there's huge leaks coming out of the oil fields. And to me, it's another limited resource. It doesn't make any sense to take your home from oil to natural gas. I just don't think it makes sense, or propane, as the case may be, when there are alternatives.
Right.
And so in your case, you know, you've got solar hot water, you're burning wood, you're using solar electricity. My own place, my place at the lake, if you will, I've got also 1.2 kilowatts of solar power. I've got an HRV, a heat recovery ventilator. So that in the wintertime, when the house is sealed up, and I have done a pretty amazing job at sealing it up, I've got ventilation, I've got good air quality. I will say, too, that there's a couple of side benefits to doing a good job of insulating and sealing. I've eliminated the rodent problem. and the other, just the little indicator, if you will, if you have cluster flies in your house, you know your house isn't very well sealed.
Right.
And I have one cluster fly a year. That's not a cluster of fly. That's one fly a year. Because you just seal it up and you solve the problem. So in my case, I do burn wood in that house, but I also use electric. I use electric infrared, and I use electric radiant to take the chill off and maintain temperature, especially when I'm not there, all on thermostats and timers and programmable thermostats. And I still have, with 1.2 kilowatts of solar, I still have a credit of 800 kilowatts with Bangor Hydro. So
that's great.
You can do this stuff.
Yeah.
It just is not that complicated. Mm-hmm. And on the industrial scale, if I phrase it that way, again, if you can build a 70-bed dorm that's net zero energy, anybody can do their home, or anybody can do a building.
Right.
It's partly depending on the siting, obviously.
Sure.
But in general, it's possible to do this stuff. And so, as you said, any of these things can save 20% or 30% for the various efforts that you make. So many people think that they're going to put thousands of dollars in and save 10%.
Mm-hmm.
No, not if you do it right.
Yeah.
It's possible to get there. And I'll come back to another personal story here. I closed on a house in Waterville, not far from campus, just yesterday. So I have not done anything at this point, but it's got an old oil boiler. It's got an old oil tank that's going to have to be replaced at some point. I got a quick estimate of $1,800 for it to replace the oil tank. I don't know if that's reasonable or not, but I can get an air source heat pump for $2,000 or $3,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's run electrically. I can run it with solar power, and I'm not using fossil fuels.
Right. And there's so many little things that people can do at home that are going to really save, or, you know, even from the institutional point of view. And I came up with this list of 7 or 8 items that any, you know, building, say, at Dartmouth, or a person could do that would really make a difference. And even, for example, if you have got too much space for the number of people in the house, a lot of people do that. And I know Mainers are very savvy around closing off unused areas or renting out areas to maximize the occupancy, user habits, just like turning things off and turning them down, all these simple things like the operational controls you talked about. Like, you'd have a campus with buildings all up to full temperature and there's no one there for 2 weeks of break. And you could do the same thing in your home. And you go to work, you let it go down. When you come back, you bring it up again. That's just managing it. And for a campus to manage the systems, to make sure the rooms are filled. Like, they're building a new building, but they have empty classrooms all over the place. And using more efficient appliances, heat exchangers, that's another part. Improving the insulation of a place, taking care of it so it lasts longer. Everything you don't throw away, everything you make lasts longer, you lower the footprint. And then if you do all these things, maybe 6, 8 different items, you could be down to 1/10 the energy. And now you want to put solar power or put that air-to-air heat exchanger or whatever heat pump in there, it's going to be way lower cost than if you had done it when you still had an energy hog on your hands.
We have a couple of gifts that have come in here, pledges, and unfortunately someone from Freedom has called in, and I cannot read the name on that. My apology there. But this person does say that she's especially enjoying having Jim Merkel on the program, so she mentioned him by name. So thanks for being here, Jim. And we have another anonymous gift that they just, again, point out that they especially like the public affairs programming here on WERU, and that we certainly do appreciate that. A few minutes ago, you mentioned that the example of using 20% organic food at Yale, Dartmouth, sorry, and but Yale was going 100% at that point. I recall from the newspaper in the last week or two that UMaine has made the commitment to go 20% local food, not organic food, just local food. And they're going to do that by 2020, I think. And it's just one of those things. Pardon me, I'm an alum, but come on.
It's a little too late.
one of the issues that I have as a sustainability person is that we, society, nibble around the edges.
And right.
Maybe that's an interesting analogy for the food situation, but let's make the commitment and let's do it.
Right. See, at Dartmouth, they wanted me to work on recycling, and I just said, no, I'm not hired. You didn't hire me as a recycling person. They had 30-year recycling program, and I studied all the data they had, and they hadn't increased the rate in 30 years. And I'm saying we should go to a no-waste system, zero waste for the whole campus. And they were fighting, you know, in a way I had to fight uphill, but we had 11 dining halls. So they finally let me have one dining hall to create a waste-free dining hall. And basically we just got all the packaging out of the whole dining hall and had no throwaway cups, plates, spoons. And I had done an analysis of everything that they buy that's throwaway. So the students were, campus was paying $1.15 a day to give students garbage to eat on. And if you take that money, you could go waste-free with that $1.15 a day and be done with it. And now you have, like, only a compost bin at the end at a dining hall. So when we did this to a dining hall, at the end of a meal with 500 students being served, they had a bag of garbage that you could hold in your hand. It would weigh like 2 pounds, you know, not even. That was miscellaneous kids brought in. So, but after that, the president had a barbecue with 5,000 people. He says, let's go waste-free. After that, they had alum dinner with 1,000 people. They said, let's do that waste-free. Then there's a Prouty bike ride. 5,000 people do this bike ride to raise funds for cancer. They called me up. Let's do it waste-free. Then my brother's wife, my brother's a Harley rider, you know, and we're having a family gathering with, you know, for 4 days that we get together. And they're not like environmentalists, but they're cool people. But we get there and she says, Jimbo, we're having no throwaway plates, no forks. She got all this, everything is reused. We usually just have plates and throw them away. No one wanted to wash dishes. Then she sewed like our names on napkins for everybody there. Like, you know, consciousness grows crazy when people like take bold steps. So like, I think the more bold we can be and challenge ourselves, like let's be waste-free, let's have zero energy. All these things are great because we can do it. The technology is there, the knowledge is there, the information is there, the will is there, and then it'll generate excitement. But say, let's reduce our recycling rate 5%. Blah.
Mm-hmm. Recycling really ought to be considered the entry-level drug to get people hooked on the concept of sustainability. But in reality, we can do so much more. And you're right. I mean, the state of Maine, for example, has hovered between 30 and 40% recycling for decades, I think. One of the opportunities, I believe, is to go to zero sort recycling. That's something to get people off the perceived problem of sorting and having lots of bags everywhere.
Sure.
So, you know, that can bump us over 50%, but we still have to do much better. So my understanding was at Dartmouth that you did one zero waste dining facility. Is that correct?
Yeah.
What was the impediment to doing more than one?
Boy, I would get pushback from the dining staff, and they said, well, see, they make money off of giving students packaged stuff in the coolers, like chips and soft drinks. That's a high margin for them. And so they didn't want to give up giving students junk food. And I would say, wait a minute, you know, we shouldn't be in a business here to make money off the students by giving them junk. And so they were, you know, slow, reluctant to have to rethink how they make money, because Dartmouth ran all their dining facilities. They didn't contract them out with these huge people. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. So the guest, when we're talking with Jim Merkel, who actually lives in Belfast. We hadn't mentioned that yet. He is local. And we're talking about a wide range of things relative to including home energy and basic philosophy of recycling. I have a couple of notes here again. I think the name is George from Unity, has come in and given us a gift and said very specifically that he likes these public affairs programs. And I also comment that the three people that have donated so far, total, we're just slightly short on Jim's matching pledge of $100. So if somebody would be interested in making a little bit of an additional pledge, we got an additional $100 from Jim. Very, very generous. We certainly do appreciate that. One of the things that strikes me as we talk about food and we talk about net zero energy, deep energy retrofits, Maine builds schools and it runs schools. And I'm talking about public schools now, high schools and elementary schools. We because we've come from an academic institution background, we're talking about how academic institutions can model the right behavior and get students involved in this and even try desperately to pull the administrators along to think in the right way. But the opportunity for Maine to build net zero energy schools and to go with local foods, and I mean, because our, you know, we've got lots of rural schools that are out there hiding in agricultural fields. It just seems to me that the opportunity is there to set our students in the right direction and influence their parents.
Sure.
Is huge. And I've been a proponent for years to say, why do we approve a school with state matching funds that's not net zero energy?
Mm-hmm.
We just need to do that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, that's great.
So let's see. Let's looping back here through my notes in terms of what we've talked about. One thing that we talked about before the show started that I wanted to make sure we brought up is that you're in the process of putting together a film with the nonprofit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. The film is called The 100-Year Plan, and it's basically looking at how we can, over the next 100 years, address the population issue. A lot of people will say, well, population, what are you going to do about that? And the other issue is huge consumerism and also the power of corporations basically to rig the system and work extreme extraction. So the film is really looking at how do we get to deal with the population issue. And what's happening around the planet is wherever child survivability has really increased, poverty has been kind of dealt with, and women have been giving choices for contraception and safe legal abortion, the family size has gone very small. So there's examples, like, for example, in Cuba, Kerala, India, where I had done research in both of these places, their infant mortality rate in Kerala, India, is one-fifth that of the rest of India. They live, 75 years. Their literacy is really high. So the government there, I was there for 5 months studying this. 50 years ago, they decided, let's have a universal safety net, universal free education, health care, food security, housing. They dealt with all that stuff. Cuba did the same thing 50 years ago. And so a Cuban lives longer than an American. They have a lower infant mortality rate. Cuba's ranked fourth in the world in literacy. U.S. is at like 34th. They have a fraction of the prison population, although we say Cuba's people are under this despot government. That people have to study it in more detail, too. But it's got challenges, but also they have a fraction of the prison population that we have in so-called free America. So these examples, the film is going to go and study in detail, also to Slovenia in Europe, where they have infant mortality even half that of the U.S., and the best policies for women in the workplace. And so the film ultimately wants to say, well, we can get to a sustainable planet. So if you just start putting in family size, the size of European family are about 1.5 child families right now. You put that into a population growth model, and by the year 2100, the population is decreasing now with 1.5 child families. It's more or less exponential growth in reverse, and the population can be down to 4 billion instead of 7. So right now we're planned status quo is humans grow from 7 to 11 billion by 2100, UN estimates. But if you reduce that by half a child, average family size around the world, you get down below 7. Now, if you reduce it a little further, you get down to 3 to 4 billion people. It's done compassionately. There's no loser. It's just us having smaller families for the next 100 years. And the only ones left on Earth having large families are the ones in deep, deep, deep poverty and in horrible situations in Africa, the most oppressed societies. And these places often have cowboy capitalism happening, like land grabs, million acres being taken over by wealthy corporations to export food in these countries to send to Europe and to America, wherever. There's massive land grabs happening. The resources that are precious there are being controlled by multinationals from around the world, and the people are struggling. They're not getting a slice of their of the wealth of their country, and that's why they're grinding in poverty. And it's not even that hard. It's not rocket science. Like, I've done the math. 1/20 of our military, 20% of our military budget for America would eradicate poverty for the world and address climate change and provide family planning for the entire poor population of the world. Now, the $7 billion we gave to the bailout to the corporations, that could have doubled the poorest billions people's income for 7 years. And we just decided in 7 days to give it to the wealthy corporations. U.S. has the capacity to eradicate poverty tomorrow. I mean, we would probably want to airdrop McDonald's to the people. That's the consciousness we currently have. But, you know, if we were doing it by first not our interventionalism with 900 military bases around the world, you know, there's a... So the film is really going to look at how these societies have harnessed their wealth and their whole population behind the idea of let's provide a universal health safety net for the people, and it's delivered the goods. So we could get the 100-year plan is saying if we do that along with the wealthy using less, reducing our footprints, the poor have to increase of the planet. The poorest billion and the poor in our country need more. They basically need more to have a decent life. And like Bernie Sanders talking about the same thing, $15 an hour minimum wage. He's talking about universal Medicare, free education. These are things other societies have done around the world, and they have great, you know, we spend more incarcerating people than we could give a guy, you know, a degree in from Harvard, or we could put him in prison. You know, if you look at statistically, the person who, if they're of color and they graduate Harvard, they're not going to be in prison. If you're stuck in a horrible situation in inner city, you may be shot, you're a 12-year-old boy because you have a toy gun in your hand. Question's over, you know, and that doesn't happen. If I listen to Amy Goodman all the time, so I know it happens not infrequently. It happens like every week it's this happening. And we know the prison population is highest in the on the planet per capita in America. So we have no high horse to jump on of freedom and democracy. So these other societies I'm going to, people challenge, sure, they have, but there's no reason why U.S. should have had, you know, several hundred death attempts on Castro. So
I think one of the issues is that nationalism in America causes us to say that it's this country right or wrong, what we do right or wrong.
And right or wrong.
We need to question some of those things. You mentioned Cuba. Cuba was recently ranked number one country for sustainability, and you can argue with that one way or the other, but they do offer free health care and free education, and they export doctors around the world, interestingly mm-hmm. enough, out of their system, and crime is low. I ran into an interesting statistic the other day that the entire country of Norway, you probably know where I'm going with this, mm-hmm. for an entire year, the combined police forces in the entire country for the entire year fired 2 bullets last year. Compared to what goes on in America, and it's, you know, Scandinavians are consistently ranked the happiest people on the planet. Mm. They also have the highest taxes on the planet, but the highest social services. Mm. And it's such in stark contrast to things we heard on the debate last night on television.
Right.
You know, without mentioning any parties. Thank you very much. Let me just come back and say that, first of all, I have a note here that said, hooray, we made it. We've matched your grant, so thank you so much for doing that. We have a number of anonymous people here who don't want their names mentioned, but this one person said, issues raised on power to the people are great. Thank you so much. Another person here, again, anonymous, especially like the public affairs programming here. And I think it's George from Unity, just to go back and acknowledge George, likes these programs very much, gave a gift a few minutes ago. Unfortunately, can't read the name on this one, but the person from Freedom appreciated having Jim Merkel on the program and appreciated his philosophy. And then, again, I'm having a little trouble reading it. It's Something Hill Farm in Penobscot. If you're in Penobscot, hopefully you know what that is. And they gave a business gift and said that they enjoy listening to this program as well. So we certainly appreciate the outpouring support from all of these folks. We've got a few minutes left. Again, our guest is Jim Merkel. from Belfast, who's written Radical Simplicity and has a host of personal experiences and professional experiences that relate to sustainability and energy solutions. Have time for another phone call or two if anybody wants to call in, both either for a pledge at the pledge number of 800-643-6273, or if anybody wants to call in and chat with us here in the last few minutes of the program, the call-in number for the program is 866-625-9378, and that's 866-625-WERU here on Community Radio, WERU-FM. So let's see here. Looking back on my notes, one of your comments that I jotted down that I was amused by was that you felt you couldn't be an environmentalist by night and be everything else but during the day. Thank you for the clarification on that. That's King Hill Farm in Penobscot. Again, thank you for your business gift. So I think there's a lot of environmentalists by night out there who don't quite get it done during the day. And to me, the ways to start are to think about decisions. So, for example, if you've got an oil burner, an oil boiler, and it's at the end of its life, you don't necessarily just go out to your oil boiler guy to say, what do I do next? Because there's a conflict of interest there. And if you install another oil boiler, you've just signed yourself up for several more decades of oil consumption. So we need to be careful on the status quo being the way we handle things. So we have a phone call from Chris from Thomaston. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the air.
I just recently had to replace my water heater, and I'd always thought when my water heater died that I'd get one of those hybrid electric heat pump type water heaters. Right now I have just a propane tank, like a 40-gallon tank. But doing the research on it, I kind of panicked, and I just couldn't pull the trigger on it because it just seemed like the reviews were all over the map. I was looking at the GE one that Lowe's carries, and it was like $1,000. I knew there was a matching grant you could get from Efficiency Maine for $500, but I just got kind of scared of the technology because it just seemed like it was complicated and unreliable, and some people loved them, but a lot of people were like, this thing is garbage, don't buy it. And I was just wondering what you thought of that. And I was also wondering, I ended up going with what I had basically, and I was wondering if there's any advantage to having an on-demand system in terms of energy savings. I mean, considering that the house has three people in it and there's probably not much going to waste in the water tank, I didn't know if there was an efficiency difference in trying to heat the water quickly like you would with an on-demand system, or if it made no difference in terms of gas usage.
Right. Well, let's see if in the couple of minutes we have left, let's see if we can, between Jim and I, if we can come back and address that. So there's no doubt there are products out there, especially in the early years of hybrid hot water heaters, that may be getting poor reviews. I actually haven't run into that. The ones that I've talked to and read online and talked to people at Efficiency Maine, the reviews have been great. So I think in general, it's a technology that is... It sounds complicated, but it really, I mean, it's a combination heat pump with electric heat, and a heat pump is nothing more than a refrigerator, depending on, it could be running frontwards or backwards, depending on how you're running it, but it's basically refrigeration. So the technology makes an awful lot of sense, and I think if you do a little bit of research, you can find a reliable brand. Solar Assist, of course, is another possibility that you can go and you could run solar into an electric system or otherwise. Jim, maybe you want to comment while I read the comments from more people coming in with pledges. You could comment on the on-demand.
Yeah. Well, I had looked into on-demand systems when I put the solar system in, but I actually was able to the solar actually worked. But I did find there were some pretty decent on-demand systems out there.
Okay. All right. I would tend to agree with that. So real quick, we have Boyd from Augusta who called in. Likes this program and public affairs program. And Rebecca from Lincoln also called in to give a gift as well. Said she and her husband listen to this all the time, and they enjoy these types of programs. So my thanks to Jim Merkel, the guest today, talking about a wide range of things. And we've had lots of calls calling in to pledge. And thanks to Chris from who called in just a few minutes ago to ask a question. So that's a wrap for this week's show. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Great, Steve.
We'll see about having you back on, because I think there's a lot more that we didn't get to cover here, especially specific things relative to homeowner needs and homeowner opportunities.
Super. Great, Steve. All thanks right. for the show.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Support for WERU comes from our listeners and from Penobscot.